So we have the Grignard reaction and the Wittig reaction that are both ways of forming carbon-carbon bonds. The main difference between the two is a Grignard reaction forms a carbon-carbon single bond, whereas a Wittig reaction forms a carbon-carbon double bond. And what we're about to see is an example of a Grignard reaction, but also an example of how you might have difficulties using a Grignard reaction to get to the product that you want, and therefore seeing why we might want to use the Wittig approach instead. So I've started out with a ketone, 3-methylbutane-2-one, and I'm throwing an alkyl magnesium halide at it. This is the classic example of a Grignard reagent, an organometallic reagent. And you might recall from Monday's lecture that that is effectively going to act as if it is methyl minus. So methyl group attacks the carbonyl, pushes it open. We initially end up with an alkoxide. Normally, you do a very gentle acid workup. Which will get you to the alcohol, although in this case, if we left it in acid and heated it up, we could cause a dehydration to occur. And this is the normal product or the most favorable product we might expect from that dehydration. Because the first steps would be for the alcohol to get protonated and come off, which in this case would form a tertiary carbocation. Rearrangement's not impossible, but unlikely because you already have a tertiary carbocation. And when elimination occurs under heat like this, it tends to be the more substituted alkene that forms because it's the one that's more favorable thermodynamically. Now, this lab that's upcoming that I just referenced a minute ago, the kinetics versus thermodynamics lab, we're going to get much more into how could we control the products of a reaction by changing conditions. And what I'm getting at is that last quarter, we did learn how to do eliminations, but there were two possible eliminations that could occur. One like this, which is the thermodynamic product. That's known as a Zaitsev elimination. Whenever the more substituted alkene, the more thermodynamically favored alkene forms, that's Zaitsev elimination. But we did a few examples last quarter of causing the opposite behavior, where you'd have elimination to form a double bond that is not the most substituted one. And sometimes that's referred to as anti-Zaitsev behavior. Sometimes that's called Hoffman elimination, when we're talking specifically about elimination. And what I'm trying to show is, let's say that we wanted to make an alkene out of this intermediate alcohol, but make it such that the double bond goes to the terminal position. So that would leave only two substituents of the double bond, which is less favorable than the four that I just formed a minute ago. But we can force that reaction to happen if we use the right kind of reagents. So first I'll turn this into a leaving group, because I need a leaving group to do elimination. But then I'll use potassium T-butoxide. That T-butoxide, because it's so bulky, it makes it more difficult for it to access the tertiary proton than it would need to in order to eliminate and make the product that I showed originally. So thermodynamically, yes, it would still be more favorable to eliminate to the interior. But if you had a bulky reagent like this, and let's add to that, let's say we do this reaction at low temperatures. Well, low temperature, it's going to be the activation barrier that really controls what kind of reaction is going to happen. In other words, only those reactions that there's enough energy to happen will be the ones that tend to happen. And that's kinetic control. So low temperature and using a hindered base like this, making the approach more difficult, will steer this to reacting with a primary hydrogen instead because it's more accessible. And so this will give us the Hoffman elimination product. Since it's something I guess I really do want you to know, let me take the minute to go back and annotate the notes a bit. So this is the thermodynamic product. And again, just like we have the term Markovnikov to describe the usual pattern of substitution that we get when we add something to a double bond, Zaitsev is the term that we use to describe the thermodynamic formation of a double bond. And then down below here, this is the kinetic product. I don't remember if Hoffman's 1N or 2Ns, but that is the name often given to this kind of elimination, or it's sometimes called anti-Zaitsev as well. And I'll write a brief summary of what I said about low temperature control, but that's something I'm going to go much, much more into detail when we do hit that kinetics versus thermodynamics lab. But to just sort of meld or dovetail into that lab, let me write this description. At low temperatures, only those reactions with lower activation barriers tend to predominate. Even if they result in products that may not be as favorable thermodynamically. When a large, bulky base is used to perform eliminations, a less favorable product may be formed because of the difficulty the base has at accessing a more sterically hindered hydrogen. That's exactly what we did in this example. Use T-butoxide, bulky base, would more easily grab just that primary proton in this example than the tertiary that would have otherwise given us the thermodynamically more stable product. Now, we were able to get to this product in this case, but there could be other cases where we might imagine we want to make an alkene where elimination might get us three different potential products. So, is there a way we could force this particular reaction to occur? And the answer turns out to be yes, and that's what we can do with a Wittig reaction. So the Wittig reaction has a unique type of reagent normally used, just like a Grignard reaction generally has those alkyl magnesium halides as reactants. We are not starting at the first step in our own lab with the Wittig reaction. So first I'm going to show you an example that's not what we're doing in lab, show you how normally it's done, and then I'll switch over to talk about the specific case of what we are doing in lab and how it's a little bit different, a little bit special. So in general for a Wittig reaction, you start with an alkyl halide or an alkyl tosylate. And you react it with a compound called triphenyl phosphine, which, let me show you this. A benzene ring is sometimes abbreviated with the symbol pH, because a benzene ring, when it's a substituent, is called a phenyl group. pH, we could write that also as the Greek letter phi, which is often done, because it makes it a heck of a lot easier to abbreviate the compounds that have lots of benzene rings in them, like triphenylphosphine. So triphenylphosphine I can write as P-phi-3. That phosphorus is even more nucleophilic than a nitrogen would be, even though this phosphorus is not as basic. It's the same story that we have with oxygen versus sulfur. Sulfur being lower on the periodic table is squishier, that's the technical word, and therefore more able to start bond formation during a substitution reaction. So same thing here. This is a relatively easy SN2 reaction. And let me write the name of this compound. This is triphenylphosphine. And the general name for this is a tetraalkyl phosphonium salt that initially we make. Now I just realized I need to rewrite this a little bit. I want to explicitly show one of the hydrogens here because I want to show the next step. Next step is to deprotonate this compound. This compound deprotonates a little bit more easily than just a standard old alkane, because we do have this positive charge next door that would interact favorably with a negative charge if one were to form next to it. Now, phosphorus already has an octet as written, but phosphorus being on the third row of the periodic table can have an expanded octet. That's our watered down phrase for meaning a complicated orbital interaction can occur. But in other words, you can put more than 8 electrons in the valence shell of phosphorus, which we'll see what that results in just a moment. So although this is more acidic than a standard alkane, you still usually need a pretty hefty base to deprotonate one of these compounds. Now, if you're doing a general Wittig reaction, the reagent that often is used is N-butyl lithium. Now, the N you might not have seen all that much. I know I must have mentioned it last quarter, but we didn't use it. You're probably more familiar with tert-butyl and sec-butyl and isobutyl, but N-butyl means normal. Which means unbranched. So N-butyl lithium is butane with lithium sticking off. It's similar to the Grignard reagents, where it acts as if it is a carbanion. It is a carbon with a negative charge, which carbanions are really, really basic. And so what we could show is N-butyl lithium deprotonating this tetraalkyl phosphonium salt, which will make something that has two different names that we could call it. General term for a compound that has both a plus and a minus charge on it is zwitter ion, which literally means twin ion. And where you'll more commonly see that term is with amino acids. So if any of you have done any study of amino acids, they're called amino acids because they have an amine portion, which is a base, a nitrogen, and you have a carboxylic acid portion, which is an acid. They therefore can self-neutralize in solution, forming both a carboxylic acid salt and an ammonium salt. So you get both a plus and a minus on the same molecule. This is an even more special version of one called an illid. If you think about the ending ill, we often see that in names like the methyl group or a methyl carbocation. So ill itself doesn't mean positive charge, but it's often used in names with positive charges. The ide ending, think of halide, oxide, nitride, negatively charged. So this illid is really plus minus, right next door to each other. Which, again, because phosphorus could have more than a standard octet, we could write a resonance structure for this compound. And showing it as being a neutral, doubly bound compound. I tend not to show the resonance structure. I tend to leave it as the illid, just because it's fewer things to write down. But just be aware, you might see other texts that do explicitly go through this resonance step. But since you've probably heard my resonance story enough times, realize there is no difference between those two structures. It's just two different ways to write it. Now, how does this critter react? Well, let's throw it at the same ketone that I used in the Grignard reaction, the Grignard example. A Grignard reagent, as you might expect, is fairly polarized because it has both a positive and a negative terminus. Well, a negative carbon, that's very likely to attack a carbonyl. That's what a Grignard reagent does. So I'll have this attack the carbonyl, push it open. Once that occurs, recognize that they're not connected to each other, but in space, there's a positive and a negative charge. They're practically next door to each other. And so very rapidly, you'll end up forming a four-membered ring. Not normally favorable to make a four-membered ring, but because of the opposite charges. It does occur. There is a naming system for what are called heterocyclic compounds. So you might remember the term heteroatom means something besides carbon and hydrogen. So if you have hydrocarbons and you modify them, those extra atoms are called heteroatoms. Using similar terminology, a ring that has something other than carbon as part of the ring is called a heterocycle. And there's a special nomenclature that doesn't have number endings. They're just words that have been created that then themselves mean three or four or five or six-membered ring. So this intermediate has the name oxaphosphatane. The etane ending means four-membered ring. The phos portion of it means that you've replaced a carbon with phosphorus. The oxa means you've replaced a carbon with oxygen. So oxaphosphatane is a really just complicated way of saying four-membered ring with an oxygen and phosphorus in it. In this case, where you have that kind of structure, it rapidly decomposes because it is enormously favorable to form a phosphorus-oxygen double bond. So that's what drives the decomposition of this intermediate. You don't even isolate this, it just reacts and decomposes. One of the things that spit out is triphenylphosphine oxide. Which is a thermodynamic brick, meaning it's very favorable to form. Anything that's favorable to form, which might imply the release of energy, that's why something would want to occur. At the same time, Notice that we end up with an alkene. Not a single bond, and there's no more oxygen there, but a double bond directly. So just the Wittig reaction by itself gave us exactly what we would have wanted from a Grignard reaction followed by an elimination. Since there is no rearrangement that occurs, then this lets you make the double bond in a very specific location. And that's part of the synthetic advantage of using a Wittig reaction. So now let me show you the version of this that you're doing with the chemicals, what you're doing in real life. First, a comment on the fact that we're not doing that initial SN2 reaction. Part of the reason is time. Part of the reason is triphenylphosphine is a neurotoxin. And given the cleanliness of the OChem lab in general, I don't think I would want to give you all a neurotoxin to play with. So we start out with an intermediate, the second step, which for you is benzyl triphenylphosphonium bromide, correct? Do we all remember what the term benzyl means? If you're like section one, it's kind of like, I know I should know that, but that was last quarter. That was so many weeks ago. So let me review for you some of the common names that you better know. If you have something directly attached to the benzene ring, then that's that phenyl term that I used just a moment ago. If you put one more carbon in between whatever is substituted and the benzene ring, then that is benzyl. And benzyl compounds are unusually reactive because if you dissociate and put a carbocation on there, the carbocation is delocalized heavily. In fact, you can form a carbocation there even though it's primary because you don't have hyperconjugation from the benzene ring. You've got full-on conjugation with the benzene ring. Similarly, it is easier than normal to form an anion at a benzyl position, again because of delocalization resonance with the benzene ring. Other common names as reminders: if we put something directly on a double bond, that's the vinyl position. If we put something one carbon away from a double bond, that's the allyl position. And then the last common name I remember us covering is one position away from a triple bond, which is called the aspargyl position. So, we were talking about benzyl triphenyl phosphonium bromide. Ooh, which I forgot this for the morning section, so I don't want to make the same mistake again. We are going to reduce all the quantities in today's lab by 1/3. So again, 1/3 quantities for all reagents, solvents, etc. We're going to run out of the starting materials otherwise. So you start with this material. Again, we don't do the SN2 reaction because of concerns about triphenylphosphine. We're also not using N-butyl lithium, which is a good thing. N-butyl lithium is sold as a solution, very easily available, very, very, very reactive. Can give you quite a nasty burn if it gets on you because it's that darn basic. But because we have the benzene ring right next door, and because we have the positive charge on the phosphorus, both of them together make that proton that's between the two acidic enough that with long-term heating and sodium hydroxide, we can get sodium hydroxide to do the deprotonation. So it's an unusual reaction that we can use hydroxide here instead, and that's, for instructional purposes, the advantage of using this benzyl reagent. And in fact, let me make a comment about that. So as we'll learn in just a couple of weeks, it is not in fact favorable to break up a benzene ring. But it does explain some of the reactivity of this molecule. So we have this deprotonated salt, the ilid, which again I'll write in sphenoionic form. We're going to react that with benzaldehyde. I didn't mention it this morning, but I can tell I didn't need to, but I'll ask, does anybody have an allergy to almonds? An allergy to almonds? Well, then you're too late to answer now, because if you have an almond allergy, you have an allergy to benzaldehyde, not good to handle it. But since nobody said that you had that allergy, that means you don't get to do the lab. Now you've got the allergy that you suddenly developed, right? I'm going to use benzaldehyde. The anion's going to attack, just like we saw previously. This is just the same reaction, but with the reagents you're really using. Once that attack occurs, and by the way, be careful with the number of carbons that you're writing. It's very easy in a Wittig reaction to accidentally leave something out. And of course, I didn't draw the geometry quite right here, but there is the four-membered ring that's going to form. Now, one thing that is useful about the way I wrote this is notice I wrote this with the two benzene rings on opposite sides of the single bond from each other. Well, I could have written the two benzene rings on the same side as each other, which doesn't matter as long as there's a single bond because you can freely rotate around a single bond. But as soon as you close up and make that four-membered ring, well, you've locked in the relative position of the two benzene rings. In fact, let me show you the two possibilities that result, and I'm going to start abbreviating to make the structures quicker to write. One moment. Ah, that's the part I'm leaving out. So we'll have two different stereochemical possibilities. Of course, for either of them, we technically could have enantiomers as well, but we're about to make a double bond, so that gets rid of the worry about enantiomers. But when that double bond forms, if the two phenyl rings are pointed the same way versus the opposite way, then when the decomposition of this oxyphosphatane occurs, we're going to have the possibility of forming both the cis product and the trans product. Now let me flip over to talking about procedure, because
in theory, you're supposed to do this reaction and then perform an isomerization. I don't want us to do the isomerization. I want to see what the raw proportion of the cis versus the trans compounds are. And so that means we're going to cut out part of our procedure. So let me walk through the procedure. Again, 1/3 quantities of all reagents, just to reduce the amount of material that's being used. This is an interesting reaction because it's a one-pot reaction. You put both reagents in to start with, both the benzaldehyde and the benzyl triphenylphosphonium bromide, because nothing will happen between the two of them until the illid forms. When you throw sodium hydroxide in, benzaldehyde will not undergo a reaction, not rapidly. That's something we'll study next quarter. So the only thing that can happen productively is the deprotonation of the phosphonium bromide to make the illid, which then will immediately react with the benzaldehyde that's already in solution with it. So you have a half-hour addition, and it does say to do the addition of the sodium hydroxide dropwise. And that's so that you slowly form the vitic reagent, which then immediately reacts with benzaldehyde. The sodium hydroxide solution, by the way, I believe has already been prepared, so you don't need to make it from the solid. Points off for bottles being left open anymore. Don't you all make the same mistake. Starting to really annoy me, you can't do the simple things. I may not sit and watch you all every single second that you're in lab, but that's because you're adults and I expect that you can follow simple safety guidelines. So I'm just announcing for the recording that starting on Monday, I guess, anytime I see reagent bottles left over, I'm going to carry through with that thread at the beginning of the quarter, take points off of lab reports. Can't do it anymore, especially if you all want to be employed. You think you'd be kept on a job if you did something like that? So, let's see. What was I saying before I saw that? Sodium hydroxide. Sodium hydroxide has already been prepared. So you're going to put your reagents all together, add your sodium hydroxide dropwise while heating. I'm going to say that we can get away with the air condensers because I suggested the morning section they use the air condensers instead of the water, and nobody said they had difficulty with that. The way to tell if the air condenser has not been working for us properly is, remember that heating at reflux is so that you're causing the solution just barely to boil, that vapor rises up, condenses in the tube, you can actually see the line of where the vapor makes it up to, and then the solvent falling down from that. So that continual process of evaporation and that little miniature waterfall, that's the heating at reflux. And if the reflux level gets up to the point where it's at the top of that condensation tube, well, that means it's about to all escape and you're about to just boil your solvent off, which you don't want. So if it looks like that condensation line gets to the top, then you need to switch over to your water condensers. But no one this morning said they had to do that, and that's why I'm going to assume that we can just get away with doing the air condenser. So you add your reagent slowly over half hour, you're letting it stir. You then have a series of washes and isolation steps that you do. First you add the, by the way, dichloromethane is the same thing as methylene chloride, if you've forgotten the two different common names. So I don't know what the bottle over there is called, but both names are appropriate. So you're supposed to add some of that and some water to help make two different layers, because you're going to retain only the organic layer. You then do a series of washes, which include just plain water. I guess that's that initial amount of water, just to get out some of the ionic leftover impurities that you have. You do a bisulfite wash to reduce any of the triphenylphosphine oxide that might be around. Triphenylphosphine oxide is difficult, notoriously difficult to get out of solutions. It seems to like to stick to everything. But that's in theory why we're using bisulfite? That's why we're using that bisulfite wash, and then we follow it up with one more water wash, correct? Just to make sure we get out all the ionic impurities that you can. You then throw it over a drying reagent, filter out that solution, and then it says to reduce down the volume partially, and then you continue with the isomerization. But we're not going to do the isomerization. So once you've done the washes and you've done the drying, you then need to evaporate out all of the solvent. And we're at least going to do IR, and this might possibly, depending on solubility, be the reagent or the product that we use this quarter to do NMR, which, as a warning, we will begin NMR again on Monday of next week. And last quarter we covered all the theory aspects of it. We're going to start with structure elucidation on Monday. So seeing spectra and being able to determine the structure.
Since we have the other lab too, what area should we get to at least today for the lab?
You mean you still have the other labs previous to deal with?
So where is a good place to stop?
After the addition of all the sodium hydroxide, if you just let it stir for a while, there will be no harm in that. So even if, in theory, you only get up to the reflux itself, if you know that you're good with your technique and you're quick, you can do those washes, the drying, and the evaporation all on Monday. Focus on lab one first, since that's due a week from today. You could always, if you had to, do an IR for lab two on Monday, since your lab report isn't going to take that long to write. Almost done. But yeah, I guess that's it. So don't do the isomerization. Do evaporate your solvent once you've done the washes and the drying. Do get your reflux done today. Then after you've got your reflux completed, then worry about your IRs.